Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and this is the podcast about all things undisclosed. Now, the addendum is a chance for us avid listeners to take our thoughts, issues, and questions straight to the team, as well as some very special guests. As you know, Season 2 of Undisclosed is investigating the mysterious, tragic death of Isaac Dawkins. On the night of January 11th in the year 2000, Isaac's truck jumped a median and plunged off U.S. Route 27 in Rome, Georgia. When witnesses got to him, he was bleeding and unconscious. It wasn't until a CAT scan at a local hospital that they discovered the cause of the accident. Isaac had been shot. A young man named Joey Watkins was convicted of his murder. Joey has already served 16 years of a life plus 5-year sentence for a crime that he may not have committed. And with us today are all three of the Undisclosed team. Yay, the band is back together. And once again, a very special guest. So it's Rabia, Susan, and Colin. Say hello, folks.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hi, John.
And we also have Claire Gilbert from the Georgia Innocence Project. She's an attorney and the interim director. She blogs at georgiainnocenceproject.org. And prior to the GIP, she worked several years as a public defender and a policy lawyer with the Government Accountability Project. Hello, Claire.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. So in this second episode, In Situ, we heard about how the case of Joey Watkins came before the Undisclosed team, their first trip to Rome, Georgia, murder coyotes, and the enormity of the task ahead. So, Claire, you mentioned that Joey Watkins was wealthy, which I didn't picture from the first episode, and that he went around in fancy cars. Is it unusual for the Georgia Innocence Project to become involved with a case where the subject has a lot of monetary resources?
It is, actually. We do have a couple of examples where it was professionals who had established careers or were up and coming who ended up being faced with these charges. But for the most part, our body of clients and people writing to us are people who are easy for the police to target. So there are often people of minority races, African Americans, Latinos with criminal histories who've been on the streets or who have problems coming in contact with the law before, or who have poverty issues and have frequent encounters with law enforcement. So it is unusual and different than the mainstream cases that we get. In Joey's case in particular, I'm not sure wealthy is the term, but his family had money. His father owned, I think it was 2 car lots that his father had. And he sold used cars, then went and repoed those cars if people didn't make the payments on them.
Well, that would explain why he had the fancy cars then, I guess.
Exactly. And the fancy cars, they were like drag racing cars. Joey would buy cars and fix them up and then resell them. And he sort of had an access to those resources through his family. And also he worked hard and earned money in doing that. But his family had a fairly large house. They had a pool. He had more money than most.
So my understanding is that the family had money at the time when this crime occurred. But did I hear correctly? It sounded like they spent more than $1.5 million on his defense. Is that correct?
That's what his father says, yes.
So I imagine they don't have those resources anymore.
Correct. They are struggling now.
How many teams of lawyers have they had to pay? How many appeals and stuff have they had to pay for out of pocket?
The trial attorney, Rex Abernathy, was the Bobby Lee Cook firm. So that was tens of thousands of dollars for the trial. Then they had a direct appeal, which was another, I think it was $35,000 plus the cost of the transcripts. Then additional fees paid to the firm after that, according to Johnny. Then they apparently paid other attorneys to sort of help and consult along the way. They had a habeas attorney by the name of Chris Frazier, who was later disbarred, and they paid him a large sum of money to do the habeas. And Mr. Frazier was disbarred for taking money for habeas filings and then never actually pursuing them, which is what happened in Joey's case. His habeas was filed in 2002 and never went anywhere until they fired Mr. Frazier years and years later, and he got a new habeas attorney, Bud Seaman. The family also paid large sums of money, somewhere between $25,000 and $50,000 for a private investigator to work on the case. And they also had to pay for the habeas attorney. by the time it got to Bud Seaman, Bud was recognizing that the family had basically been broken financially. So he was paid for the state habeas, but Bud Seaman did the federal habeas pro bono.
Wow.
Do you think that in the town of Rome, Georgia, that Joey was perceived as a rich kid?
I would definitely say spoiled, and I would say more wealthy than most. I'm not sure about rich outside of the context of this case.
Got it. So you think that it was more of his reputation as a, as you said, a loudmouth and a punk that got him the amount of ill will that seemed to metastasize at the trial.
Right. And I also think there was an issue. Joey's dad and mom have brought up a few times, and I've seen some photos, that his family was the cool family. And I grew up in a small town in Texas, and it sounds like Robbie, I grew up in a small town, and this may be common in big cities as well, but at least in the small towns, it seems like there's always one or two kids whose parents are like the party parents and allow the kids to come over and have parties at their house. They had a pool, and sounds like there were constant kids in and out of the house and hanging around there regularly. So I think they were that type of family.
I've talked to a few witnesses now from sort of Joey's group or Tandy's group from back then, and a few of them have talked about their fond memories of the Watkins and talking to them growing up over at Joey's house.
So it was largely known that they were considered a certain type of family.
Yeah, I think so. But it was a friendly, open kind of thing where they had the pool, they had the big house, like everyone would come and hang out there. They would have parties there. But Johnny and Cindy are very gracious people. And I think they were just welcoming to whoever wanted to come and hang out there. And I think that was well known.
Now, I had a procedural question. You mentioned in the Undisclosed podcast that the trial audio was not considered a public record. And I am baffled by that. I mean, it was recorded at a public proceeding by an official source. How on earth do they justify that the trial audio isn't a public record?
I agree with you. It is baffling. We have been consulting with some First Amendment lawyers who agree that it is baffling that they would take this position. There's a bit of a background to that story, factually and procedurally. Factually, as relevant to Joey's case and the Undisclosed podcast, we asked for the audio in Joey's case, and it took months and months for it to actually be located. But when it was located, the court reporter, who was the court reporter at the time of the trial and still works for the same judge, found the tapes and gave them to me and said, "Here you go. Merry Christmas. You can record these." So we started recording them. The problem was that the audio was recorded in 4-track. And so when we put the old school cassette tapes into the player and tried to feed it into Audacity, they sounded all garbled and it was unintelligible. And they were recorded at half speed, which made it sound extra fast.
Like Alvin and the Chipmunks were on trial, basically.
Exactly, exactly.
Like they're creepy cousins, maybe.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, so we asked around the various different court reporters who were there, and we noted, this is a little bit uncomfortable because we're recording this right down the hall from Judge Colston's court reporter, and Judge Colston was Tammy Colston, the prosecutor at the trial. But separate from that, we were having technical difficulties, so we told Judge Matthews' court reporter that we would be back once we figured out our technical issues. So we followed up on that, and we tried to figure out what we were going to do. And within a few days, the court reporter contacted me and said, "You know what? Judge Matthews has decided that we're not going to release those tapes to you. You can't record them." She said, "Do you have a copy of the transcript?" And I said, "Yes, we have a copy of the transcript." And she said, "Oh, because if you didn't, I'd provide you a copy. But if you have a copy, you don't need the tapes." And I explained to her, as I had previously explained, that we were working with a podcast team and that we need this for our investigation and to facilitate the podcast. And she said, "No, you know, because of that, we can't release you the tapes. There is a ongoing court case on this, and the judge does not want to release you the tapes because of that." At that point, we kind of backed up a bit because from a trial attorney's perspective, the audio of Joey's trial was not as important to us as the audio of Mark Free's trial, because Mark Free was, Joey's co-defendant who was acquitted. And because he was acquitted, there's no trial transcript. And I also was not able to locate, neither was the court reporter, any of the court reporter documents associated with the trial. So, for example, the list of witnesses who actually testified and the times and the order that they testified, we didn't have any of that. We had some information about witnesses who testified in Free's trial that was used by the appellate attorneys in the direct appeal, because one of the witnesses had conflicting testimony in Free's trial versus Joey's trial, and that became a big issue. But other than that, we really had very little idea what was going on in Mark Free's case, and it was very important to us to listen to the audio there without having that shut down on us. So we then took the tactic of trying to get Free's audio, which we ultimately did. They actually gave us the audio tapes in Free's case. They're in my office. So we recorded those, digitized those, and have those here and are protecting those, and then went back and said, okay, well, it seems that you've changed your perspective on whether we can have access to the audio. So could we please have the audio in Joey's case? And she said, no, I've already told you that Judge Matthews isn't going to release that.
Yeah, they mentioned an ongoing trial. What trial are they referring to?
So basically, there are two court cases that are pending, one in Fulton County, one in Cobb County. And the one in Fulton County concerns audio tapes, and the court in that case is refusing to release the audio. And then very recently, there was another case where a reporter was attempting to get the audio trial tapes in a case, and the judge denied that. The reporter filed an open records request, and the judge claimed that in the process of the open records request, the reporter was committing identity fraud or something like that, and had the reporter arrested for the allegations made in the open records request. So it is a very volatile situation right now in Georgia concerning the audio of trial tape.
Because the cases that she was referring to is not about this particular crime. It's like other litigation that's ongoing over this issue.
But again, it still doesn't make sense because they gave you the Mark Free trial audio.
Right.
You mentioned that they didn't prepare a transcript because he was acquitted. Could it be because of that, possibly?
That's exactly what they're saying. Because he was acquitted, they had no requirement to even maintain those tapes anymore. They could have recorded over those tapes or thrown those tapes away. And because of that, the court reporter made the decision to give us the tapes. But they are choosing not to do that, even though the law seems pretty clear that recordings of court proceedings are public records and that they should be turned over.
Yeah. Another question I had was, you mentioned that Joey did not have access to the police notes when he was tried, but that you've recently gotten them. How did you get the police notes from so long ago?
We just filed an open records request, and they were there in the file.
So how did they get missed the first time?
I don't know. It could be that it was in an active trial, pending investigation, active prosecution, and trial stage. You don't normally file an open records request to the prosecutor's office. You request these documents in the process of discovery. And they did that. There are very detailed requests from the defense wanting to see the investigator notes. However, that was never provided by the state, and it appears that the defense never followed up for that and noted it for a motion and tried to argue to the judge that they should have it.
So, of course, everybody who listens is thinking, Brady violation! I mean, that's a very bad impression of our listeners, but so that might constitute a Brady violation?
Well, it depends what's in the files, which right. We'll be covering. But there's a lot. I mean, they're big files. They're comprehensive files. The investigators did take notes. We have different sets of investigators who are taking simultaneous notes, which is interesting. So it's a good record to have. It's just kind of a shame that Joey's only getting it now.
Yeah, I mean, the question is there anything in there that is both material and exculpatory, meaning if it had been presented to the trial jury, there's a reasonable probability that Joey would have been acquitted. And we can't say anything certain now, but there definitely are at least one or two pretty good leads in the files that have been investigated and are being investigated that I think are possible Brady claims here.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I agree with that. There are many little tidbits in there and a few that really stand out that it seems like the defense should have been given access to those, to that information at the time. Whether that amounts to a successful Brady claim, we don't know. We're in the process of looking into that.
Yeah, and John, while we were in Rome, Claire and I interviewed someone in Rome, and we think following up on the evidence there that we might have discovered a Brady violation. That's something that we'll cover in a later episode and that you might be seeing in court someday soon.
Once again, the undisclosed team comes up with a Brady violation. That's, you know, it is interesting that we're coming across so many things that also affected Anand Syed's case. We've got the cell towers. We've got a witness named Jay. We've got a lawyer who got disbarred. We're just checking them off as we go down.
There's a lot of like really weird overlaps between the cases. Again and again, you're like, it's almost deja vu sometimes.
Even the relationship thing, right? It's like ex-boyfriend who is like jealous, like this whole, the way they shape the theory of the case.
Yeah, and it's weird in the sense that I wanted to follow up on this thread from before that both cases involved private attorneys and they were at different stages, but there were disbarments in both of those. And John, you were talking with Claire about the typical client for the Georgia Innocence Project. Yeah, innocence projects don't have income requirements, but public defender's offices dealing with criminal charges and legal aid dealing primarily with civil issues, whether it be housing, child custody, et cetera, those typically have income cutoffs. And that is, in most states, either 100% or 125% of the poverty level in that state, which for a single person is around maybe $15,000 to $18,000 income a year. For a family of four, maybe around $30,000. Now, in terms of criminal cases, about 80% of defendants qualify for public defenders. And when you look at those income numbers, it gives you some type of an idea of who is being prosecuted in this country. And then if you're not at those extreme poverty levels, you know, obviously we have the audio there from Joey's family about how much they put into this case. It's just almost inconceivable if you're a person who is middle class, lower middle class, and you've been charged with a crime, what exactly you can do in terms of legal representation.
If you're a family of four, and let's say you're making $38,000, $40,000 even, I mean, you're still barely getting by. And this probably has a connection to why there are such high rates of like pleas that, you know, a lot of the cases are not actually prosecuted. They're pled out. People can't afford it.
That's very true. I mean, I think especially if you have pretrial detention and incarceration, for the lower level misdemeanor crimes, I mean, it's often you either plead guilty and get out right away or you wait in trial, not being able to post bail and potentially lose your job and your family and your house and things like that in the process. So there's a strong incentive to, at least in the misdemeanor cases, to plead quickly and get out.
So, Claire, do you feel like, since you had a long history as a public defender, do you feel like there are real cases of wrongful conviction that maybe you ended up participating in? I imagine as a public defender, you're dealing with no resources and a huge workload. And so I imagine you're dealing with a lot of people who plead on things that they probably didn't do.
I think that happens a lot. I was a victim's advocate in a prosecutor's office after college and before law school and ended up in the family serious felony family violence section and essentially worked with the victims and taught them court school and things like that. And one of my big cases that I worked on involved four women who were prosecuted for ritualistic satanic sex abuse, and they ended up getting convicted. I had some serious concerns about that at the time. And they've recently become clients of the Texas Innocence Project, who has fought really hard to prove their innocence and managed to convince the prosecutor to agree to release them from prison. And that was all brought forward under Texas's junk science statute that's recently gone into effect. So not only have I seen it as a public defender in the misdemeanor context, and of course it happens at the felony level too, but also as a victim advocate kind of inside the system.
Claire, is that the San Antonio 4 case?
It is.
Claire, I have kind of a dumb question. You mentioned in the podcast that there was a volunteer named Rick Lada who put together a lot of the valuable information and timelines for you before you began working on Joey's case. But at one point you say that he left because he had to eat and he was working for free and the Georgia Innocence Project did not have the money to pay him, so he moved to Belgium. Now, I'm hoping that he understands that there are other options other than moving to Belgium to eat.
Yes.
Belgium is beautiful. Belgium is fantastic. Oh my gosh, don't get me started on Belgium. And the beer, have you had the Chimay? It's wonderful.
The beer's amazing.
But I'm hoping he's discovered that you can eat in the United States of America.
Yes, I think he's actually back in Texas now, and he pops in every now and then to volunteer and check on Joey's case.
Well, that is good to hear.
The things that GIP's managed to do on I think it's fair to say shoestring budget have been amazing, but y'all are trying to move mountains with nothing. I'm grateful to y'all for sticking with Joey's case all this long so we could be here now, but it's been a considerable sacrifice for GIP. We have hundreds of cases, and trying to keep someone on Joey's case just shows your commitment to it and how much you believe in it.
So is the actual workload at GIP hundreds of cases?
Oh, it's, yes, it is. It is.
That's remarkable.
Very, very large. We probably have 500 open files right now, which are anywhere in the process from initial letter to exoneration. But that's how many we're juggling. We have one paid staff attorney, which is me.
Wow.
And we have an annual budget right now of around $150,000.
Yeah, that's tiny. How many hours would you estimate you've spent on Joey's case alone?
Oh, thousands. I mean, definitely in the thousands. That's unusual. That is because I was working largely as a volunteer, and the GIP managed to give me a little bit of money to keep working on the case. So I was kind of coming in from the outside and really committed to working on this one case. Were we to do that again, unless we could get an outside volunteer to come in and work for pennies on the dollar, We just don't have the resources to dedicate that many hours to certain cases. The good news is that these cases are absolutely fascinating and intriguing and compelling, and we have lots of people who want to volunteer. So in many of our cases, we co-counsel with volunteer attorneys, and then we certainly have, for example, the streams of interns coming through and other people from the community offering to volunteer and help us out.
So I've also got a question for the Undisclosed team. How does the Georgia Bureau of Tourism feel about you guys publicizing the murder coyotes?
The real bad ones are up north, and they're not that bad. They've only, in terms
the
of like dangers,
murder coyotes.
They're like way behind mold on your bread.
John, you don't understand. The way Susan said it, I was just like, tell me about the wildlife in the area. And I'm an animal kind of person. She's like, oh, we've got like possum. We've got murder coyote. I'm like, wait, what? Is that how they're known? Do like local people call them murder? Is this just like a Susan thing?
That's a Susan thing.
I knew it.
But I think from now on that any murders that happen in Georgia, regardless of how they happen, we should blame on the murder coyotes. That's my thinking.
Yeah.
Okay, guys. So I'm going to go to some Twitter questions, actually. The first one is By the Lake 23, and they ask, can you do a segment on the history of Crime Stoppers, issues re, anonymity, rewards, etc. on the next addendum?
I think we'd need more than the next addendum to do that. It's just, it's something that's hard to investigate by the nature of the beast, which is probably why it's not been covered in detail before. But there's definitely, if someone has the time and resources to dedicate to it, I think there'd be a very interesting story there.
Is there any relevance to, in Joey's case, I don't think there's any Crime Stoppers stuff happening, or did it?
There's a parents of murdered children.
So it's a different organization, but the same type of thing?
There's a reward that's offered, and then it is promoted by the parents of murdered children.
John, in terms of the history of Crime Stoppers, it was in 1976, and it was Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it was actually a college student. There was a robbery at a gas station. They had been investigating the death of this college student for about 6 weeks, and they really didn't have any leads as to who committed the crime. And through the investigation, they sort of had the sense it was someone local, but they didn't have a great idea what was going on. And Albuquerque was kind of a high crime area at the time. And they decided, what we're going to do is we're going to film a reenactment of the crime. We're going to air it on TV. And hopefully someone will see it and they'll have some information. But the concern is the whole stop snitching culture. And so they thought, okay, so let's do this. We're going to entice people in the Albuquerque area with the reward. And we think that if they're given the shield of anonymity, they'll come forward. And in fact, that's what happened. A caller called in the very next day after seeing the reenactment, led the police to the two people who were responsible. And within 72 hours, the murder was solved. And then eventually that has led to, I think it's almost 1,000 Crime Stoppers organizations worldwide. And that's the thinking, is you have people who know something, they're afraid to speak, and you think, okay, we're going to dangle the carrot of the reward, we're going to have the shield of anonymity. And in many cases, it does. It leads to apprehension of criminals. In other cases, though, it leads to people who, again, going back to the poverty situation or not, that they see a way to make a quick dollar, they say, this person did it, and in fact, they're just making it up, and the person's not responsible.
Okay, we've got another question. We actually have a couple of Brianne questions. One is from Sammy Saul, who says, has Undisclosed changed any names involved? The GIP has Joey's girlfriend as Aylin and not Shay, and is Brianne a real name?
It's Aslan, actually,
oh,
and
thank you.
They were all different girlfriends that Joey had at various times.
So these are the real names?
Yes.
Right. Shay was the girlfriend at the time of the Panama City incident in July of 99, and then Aslan was the girlfriend at the time of the death of Isaac Dawkins.
Got it. And we have another one from Yurch, who says, why was Brianne at the hospital on January 12th? Who called the short-term ex-girlfriend from 4 months earlier?
It's a great question.
Yeah, very good question.
So Brianne was very close friends with Isaac's sister, which I suspect is the connection there.
Okay, we've got another one from Stephanie Bowe, who says, I think when Brianne and the rest thought they were being shot at, it was a firework. It was July.
It was July, but it was, where was it, Susan, like the last week or the beginning of the last week, so well past July 4th.
Yeah, but people still do that. In rural Georgia, you have some fun.
They do it in D.C. I still hear them going off sometimes.
Yeah, and I think there's, like, a lot of possibilities. I mean, it could have been a car backfiring. It could have been somebody, like, hunting. It's really hard to figure out what happened or if anything even happened.
Well, it seemed like, by the way, in the first episode that Susan was kind of dismissing it out of hand, that it likely never happened. But, Colin, you seem to think that it well could have. Is there any evidence to suggest that it actually did, or did I misunderstand that?
Oh, I think something happened for sure. I just don't necessarily believe someone was, like, shooting, as in trying to shoot and kill Isaac, or actually shooting at people.
Well, it doesn't make any sense as a crime. I mean, if Joey is there, so he just wants to wait there, supposedly, till they come, then fire a gun, then leave? I don't get the point of that.
And Brianne wasn't supposed to be home at all. She was staying somewhere else and apparently just stopped by the home to, like, randomly pick some stuff up there. So if Joey was there, like, he's lying in wait in a house where he knows his ex is not going to be.
And I'll say this, since we talked about it before, my opinion might have changed a bit. We'll hear more about this in episode 3. I thought there's no way that they could jump to the conclusion that someone was shooting at them, and specifically Joey, if it weren't in fact a shooter. But I now have a good deal more uncertainty about the veracity and credibility of some of these claims that have been made in this case. And the jumping to conclusions and assumptions, it's a bit more plausible for me now.
Yeah, I just feel like anytime there's a group of teenagers, things sometimes get rowdy and stories just get elaborated on and things just get amplified. And considering that there was no casing from a bullet, there was no sign of a break-in, there was just an Arby's cup in the backyard, it begs any plausibility from me.
My mom got fixated on that Arby's cup. She was like, there was no Arby's around there when I was growing up. I bet that's the clue. Someone from out of town must have done it. I'm like, Mom, there is an Arby's there now.
Thank goodness, by the way. The Jamocha shakes are unbelievable. I'm going to put that in there.
Claire, do you have any thoughts? I mean, I guess all of us discussed on the episode. Do you have any thoughts about whether you think this was a shooting or some completely blown out of proportion incident?
Well, I have a hard time imagining that nothing happened. But I've never actually thought there was really a shooting. Many years before the shooting of Isaac, Joey had received a call from a few people saying, we're coming over to your house to beat you up. And they came over and Joey met them in the garage and said, "Get off my property," and fired a gun up in the air to scare them off. And they got in the car and they left. So I always thought that maybe this incident was a blending of that incident with whatever they saw that night.
But I never believed it.
Yeah, that was a long, long time ago.
And Claire, I'm not sure I told you this, but here's what I found really interesting when I talked to Paul. He didn't remember the Breann House shooting. He just flat out didn't recall it. He told me that, I mean, if he told Moser that it happened, but he didn't remember it now. But he had a crystal clear memory of the 95 shooting.
See, that's what's fascinating to me. Also, with the other person that we spoke with about the knife incident, you know, you ask people these things 16 years later and they don't remember what you would think are the traumatic incidents, but they do remember small unrelated things or things from different points in time. And it makes you wonder where the truth actually lies.
Well, wasn't there an actual court proceeding about the second shooting? I mean, it would seem like that would cement it in your mind if you're actually getting dragged to court to testify about this stuff.
From what we can gather, there was a arrest warrant issued by Breann, and then there was a hearing associated with that. But in her citizen's arrest warrant, she doesn't mention a shooting. She doesn't mention this incident at all. And my understanding is that Joey came to the hearing for it, and it was brought up at the hearing by her father and then also by Breann. So I'm not sure the hearing was specifically convened over that. My understanding is that they were then able to prove that they were in Panama City. So the logistics of how that worked, I'm not quite sure.
We've got another one from Wish Us Donna, and she says, "Arrest affidavits are puzzling. Shooting him in the head and leaving him on the side of the road, would the police theory about what happened be just too complex for this?"
There is no police theory.
Surprise.
We shouldn't be surprised, but we are. Also, she asked, "Mark Free arrest log, no notes for Joey, but appears they were getting them to blame one another. And what is meant by the three names and mention of reward?"
I guess in most versions, you'd call him the shooter, Mark Free. And eventually, Mark and Joey are the combination they mostly settle on, although at trial, they kind of expand the circle of this little conspiracy, sort of, kind of. But for when Mark and Joey arrest at the same time, they bring them both back separate times and tell each of them, "Confess in the other and you walk free." And neither did it.
It's a classic prisoner's dilemma where they pit the two suspects against one another. You have usually a good cop, bad cop. And in this case, neither of them cracked. Neither Mark nor Joey said the other was involved. And they've maintained to this day that neither of them had anything to do with this.
Yeah, they were each told they'd get immunity, as in they would walk away like Jay.
Yeah, it says a lot about both of them, I have to say.
The question about the police theory is interesting because, I mean, we laugh with the answer that the police didn't have a theory, but they really didn't. Like, Rome Police Department never really had a theory of how this occurred or why. And then the Floyd County Police Department theory largely just seemed to change depending on the snitch of the day. I don't know if it came directly from the mouth of Stanley Sutton or through a witness that Stanley was interviewing, but there was a suggestion that it was actually the defense attorney that was planting all of these different stories for the snitches to confuse the police.
To make Stanley look stupid is what they said, I think. We'll play that clip.
What else would you say the Rex Joey took the Rex was doing about?
He was planting false information, false stories, different places. That way, when he went to court, he could prove all of them wrong and just make everybody look foolish and try to get him off that way.
This is what Rex was planning to do.
Yeah, that's his strategy.
But that's a remarkable bit of jujitsu there. We sound stupid because you're making us sound stupid.
Yes. That was the grand plan from Joey. He would confess in so many different ways that it would make Stanley Sutton look like an idiot.
Why didn't I not think of that? You know, I was going to say about the theory, the case thing, I can't help but draw parallels to Adnan's case, which is even as recently as the PCR, you have the state arguing, well, we can just change the timeline. We can change how we think the crime happened. And I think it should be mind-boggling for people that a state can get a conviction without actually deciding for good how the crime took place. Like, I didn't know that could even happen because I never practiced criminal defense law. So it's just crazy to me. I guess my question to Claire, because you are the one who has practiced it, and Susan and Colin, you guys know, does that happen like in criminal cases that the state can just not have to stick to one theory?
Well, it does happen frequently that the theories change after time or even during the trial, depending on what the witnesses say. And you can say, well, you know, you don't have to pay attention to this witness, but if you listen to this witness, yes, that happens. But the number one thing that you learn in prepping for your case is from both the defense and the prosecution perspective, from what I understand, is that you need a story, you need a theory of the case, and you need to be able to put the pieces together to give the jury something to take away, something that they can remember and that they can use to make it all make sense. And here, there was no story either by the state, other than the fact that Joey isn't evil, psychotic person who was just determined to murder Isaac and then make his family pay for it. But other than that, how that happened and the logistics of it just isn't there. The defense wasn't able to give a story either.
Does Joey have a narrative for the night that this occurred?
Oh, yeah.
That next morning, they asked him. So he has a good memory of events.
And I mean, for me, when I first read the case, when I first read the transcript all the way through, the story really stuck out to me. I was like, wow, if this was my case, and granted, hindsight is 20/20, but if this was my case, I would have focused on Stanley Sutton and how things changed when he entered the picture and how all of the pieces, when you filter them through the lens of Stanley Sutton, all of the testimony and everything that's occurring begins to make sense. But that story wasn't put forward by the defense, and the prosecution was able to go through the whole trial without even calling Stanley Sutton as a witness.
Basically, what the state is doing here, it's known as argument in the alternative. And the point, and I think we've discussed this a bit already, we'll discuss it more, is they paint in broad strokes, and they would say Joey was jealous of Isaac because he was dating Brianne after he had dated her. Joey had a history of being a bad boy, maybe having a hot head, having a temper. And then argument the alternative would be something which happens a decent amount, especially in cases when they're claiming accomplice liability, is, well, we're not sure. Was it Joey who shot Isaac? Was it Mark Free? Was it someone else? We're not sure. What we can tell you is we have this whole motive for the crime. He is the right person for this. We're not entirely sure of how it took place, but you can believe any one of these theories in the alternative, and that's enough to convict. And many times that's not good enough because it confuses the jury. But in this case, obviously, in Joey's case, they were able to say, through painting this broad picture, one of these scenarios was likely the truth. And when you dig into it, none of them really make sense.
So prosecutors are allowed to be very general about that thing. There's no rule governing what they can do.
That's correct.
Right. They don't have to have a timeline. They don't have to have a specific theory of who the actual killer was. So, for instance, you could say, look, there are these four guys and they all hated the victim. And our theory is they planned to kill him and kill him. It was on this date or maybe the next day or maybe night or maybe in the morning. We're not sure who fired the gun, but we're sure one of them did it. We're sure they planned it together. In that case, you could get a conviction of all four.
I think that's crazy.
Well, I mean, if you're a defense attorney and the prosecution has no theory and is arguing multiple things in the alternative and has no idea how it happened, that kind of just screams reasonable doubt. And you just come in and you point out to the jury, it's not good enough for them to just argue it could have been any number of these things. We don't know how. They have to prove to you beyond a reasonable doubt. You cannot have any kind of doubt based in reason as to my client's guilt.
And right, but you still have to, I mean, to get to that point, you're going to be at trial. I mean, like, the fact that somebody can get charged and arraigned and, you know what I mean? Like, even have to face trial when there's like, somebody did it and it happened somehow and we're going to charge you. That I just feel like there should be like another standard before you get to the trial and reasonable, I don't know.
you know, they have to have probable cause, and there's various different standards along the way. It's just at the trial, it's the highest standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
But I think at a trial, what you run into is a general juror bias toward the prosecution and law enforcement. I think they're generally going to say they're going to give the benefit of the doubt to the prosecutor. They're going to say, well, he generally thinks that this sort of happened this way. You know, somebody's dead. It must have happened. This is the person who hated him. And I think that's why you're going to end up with convictions where there is a very tenuous timeline.
Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of what prosecutors do is process of elimination, which is to say, this is the best candidate, and who else could it be? And that's good enough for many juries, when really the standard should be not, is he the best candidate for this murder? Instead, look at the case here. Is there a coherent narrative that you can say not only that you think this person is guilty, but that really you have no reasonable doubt? You're in, according to the Supreme Court, a subjective state of near certitude. That's the test for beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that that gets lost in a lot of criminal cases.
So I've got one last Twitter question. This is from Tiffany Snook. And she says, what is the ultimate goal for Joey's case right now? Is it a PCR hearing like Adnan's?
Well, in Georgia, it would be either an extraordinary motion for new trial or a subsequent habeas hearing. Both would need to be based on considerable new evidence. So right now, our new evidence, or, for example, a strong Brady violation recently discovered, which is also technically new evidence. So right now, our goal through the podcast is for new evidence. We really reached out to the podcast team because they do a fantastic job of getting the word out, hopefully to the local community of people who might remember things and call in information. But even through the process since November, working with the undisclosed team, who are just fantastic investigators, we've unearthed quite a bit of new evidence. And we do anticipate that we will be going back into court sometime in the not too distant future.
So one last thing that I wanted to ask, and it's actually still about Adnan's case. I've been giving Colin a huge amount of agita about the bombshell for a while. He tweeted that a bombshell had been found. And it was months ago, and he's never revealed it. And he's made it clear that there are sound legal reasons for him not to, as well as the fact that there appears to be more than one of them. And of course, you know, I respect the strategic reasoning of Adnan's lawyer, Justin Brown. But I also wanted to ask, wouldn't it serve Adnan well for the attorney general to really understand the weakness of his case right now when he's considering his options, when he can actually release Adnan a lot sooner? I know that that's not generally how things are done, but wouldn't it be good for them to understand how behind the eight ball they are at the state?
This is, yeah, one of the big complications here. And it's been a complication as we're the entire time we've been working on Adnan's case, is how much do you reveal and how much do you hold back? What could be very, very useful in court, whereas other things are maybe issues that raise eyebrows, but or they can't procedurally be raised at some point, things of that sort. I mean, I've thought about this a lot. I've thought about, even with the team of investigators working on it, and I'm not going to say who, but there's folks like running the investigation. I've said, is this something we should make public? Maybe this will like really sway the state one way or the other. But again, you know, we have to defer to his lead counsel on these issues. Having said that, you know, people keep asking the question, what if there isn't a new trial, he's offered a plea, or things, charges are dropped, will it just be buried forever? It won't be buried forever. We'll probably do like a couple of episodes on just the bombshells.
I've got to tell you, the level of anticipation for those is huge. Those are going to get like Super Bowl downloads.
You do always have that retrial in the back of your mind, and there's certain things where, as we've said, they're bombshells, and it might be that you want that witness on the stand for the state, and it's the first time the state is hearing about this in cross-examination, as opposed to, oh, okay, they're aware of this, it's out there in the public eye, and they can decide a way around that. So there's strategic reasons, and understandably, yes, you would maybe in terms of leverage for trying to get an exoneration or have the state not appeal, maybe disclose that. Maybe Justin will if there are plea negotiations between the state and him. But there are reasons why you might want to hold certain things back and not give the state notice of exactly what you have.
I mean, a prime example is what happened with Asia. And this is one consideration as we were waiting to file the post-conviction was, should we go to the media? Well, if we go to media now before post-conviction is filed, that might make Asia like prominent, right? And then the state can somehow do something that would hurt our chances with getting AJ in front of to testify. It happened anyways when they did, you know, get wind of it. And so that's the kind of fear. You don't want any interference.
And actually, I just heard that Asia had suffered a recent health scare. So we're thinking of you, Asia, and please be well. Well, thank you, guys. I just wanted to say it's been a pleasure talking to you, Claire. Thank you for bringing the case to the Undisclosed team. And thank you, team. It's always great to talk with you guys. Now, as I mentioned last week, I am donating my fees from the addendum to organizations helping the wrongly convicted. And you can't help feeling that after hearing about the threadbare operation that is the Georgia Innocence Project, lawyers laboring in utility closets and such, that maybe they can use some help. So this week, I am sending my fees to the Georgia Innocence Project. The mission of the Georgia Innocence Project is to free the wrongly prosecuted through DNA testing, to advance practices that minimize the chances that others suffer the same fate, to educate the public that wrongful convictions are not isolated or rare events, and to help the exonerated rebuild their lives. For the past 13 years, GIP has evaluated over 6,400 cases and has successfully exonerated 6 individuals who are serving time for crimes they did not commit. You can find them on the web at georgiainnocenceproject.org. And fans can discuss the show on Twitter at @undisclosed or at Joey Watkins. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use the hashtag UDAddendum, or you can tweet them directly to me or at me at Mr. John Cryer. Also, if you've got any worthy organizations for the wrongfully convicted that you'd like for me to consider donating to and highlighting, let me know and I'll check them out as well. Also, I want to remind people that there will be new case documents posted weekly at undisclosed-podcast.com. So if you're looking to delve even more deeply, check those out. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner in the Georgia Innocence Project at GA Innocence. I want to thank Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the Crime Writers On podcast for audio production, and also Hannah McCarthy for her help. And I want to thank Patrick Cortez for composing the new addenda theme and Methil Telhan as our project manager. And again, I'm going to thank you for coming back this week and hoping you'll be back again next week. Bye-bye. So the Volkov Law Group, by the way, sounds very sinister.
It does.
It sounds like it should be for Boris and Natasha from Bullwinkle. Or you should represent Klingons of some kind. But it's just normal attorneys.
How do you know I don't?